All right. Well, tonight, before we go to the phones and take your calls to solve your computer problems, we're going to talk to a special guest tonight. We're going to talk to Robert Wallace, who is the former director of technical services for the CIA. So we're going to go ahead and hit the line and say, hi, Robert.
Hello, Jay. Good evening, and great to be with everyone.
It's great to have you on the show tonight. So you have a book that you co-wrote with H. Keith Melton called Spycraft. You want to tell us a little bit about this book?
Jay, Spycraft is the story of an incredible group of men and women, scientists and engineers that worked for the CIA, an office that began in 1951 and really is America's equivalent to the Q of James Bond. These are the people that made all the disguises, the bugging devices, the covert communications, the forgeries, all of the things that are necessary to conduct espionage.
So how many people were in this group? How big of a team was this?
This represents several hundred people that are made up of engineers, scientists, technicians, craftsmen, artists, people who could do a whole variety of the special tasks on behalf of American intelligence.
Wow, how did they find all these different people? Because, I mean, it's not like, you know, the you can't put out a classified ad for make secret devices that nobody's heard of before or must have experience in, you know, tapping Russian phone lines.
Well, 60 years ago, we didn't think we could do that. But I think if you Google CIA employment these days, you'll be amazed at what you might find. the kinds of people the CIA is looking for. Yeah, I was just, and I'll answer your question, but I was listening earlier, and your comment about the Internet of 1994, the Brokaw show on that, the introduction of the Internet. There, since the Second World War, there were two major technical developments that just radically changed the face of American espionage. The first was the invention of the integrated circuit, and last month was the 50th anniversary of the patent of the integrated circuit, a patent issued in 1959, or applied for, I guess, more correctly, in 1959. And the second revolution, equally significant, was 1992-1993, when we had the simultaneous appearance of the Internet, worldwide 24/7 assured communications, network computers, and storage with a good measure. That revolution is the one that is really the significant one in today's espionage.
That would make total sense. So now, how long have you been retired or moved on from this?
I retired in 2003. I had a 32-year career with the CIA, primarily as an operations officer, or as we call it, a chief officer. And that's a non-technical job. That's the job of recruiting and handling assets that report secret information.
Were you actually a member of the CIA, or were you a contractor for the CIA?
I was a CIA federal employee, staff employee, so I want to thank all of you for your continued contributions to tax contributions to support my retirement.
And, of course, we do it all voluntarily.
That's what I understand, and, again, my appreciation is very deep.
Well, you know, and we thank you for your years of service in inducing paranoia in the average American citizen.
So, we do our best.
So, as I understand it, this book, Spycraft, you had some trouble actually getting it published. Did you struggle to get the? I know you used all declassified information in the book, but was there a struggle to get this out to print?
Yes, in fact, there was. There had really never been any book written on this topic since about the Cold War era and the early years of the war on terrorism. The only other comparable book was done by Stanley Lovell in 1963, which detailed the spy devices of the OSS during the Second World War. So that's why Mr. Melton and I decided to try to put this volume together. Mr. Melton has the world's largest private collection of spy gear, and we thought that with his equipment, you see many of the photos of many of these images and drawings of his equipment in the book Spycraft, combined with my knowledge of how the equipment was developed and used, we could make a pretty interesting story out of it. And so I hope we have.
Well, I've only begun to read the book, and it is quite fascinating. And we want to get to some of the technology that you were involved with. A lot of the things that you read about in the book are things that many people are quite familiar with from watching James Bond movies or even old Get Smart television shows. Microdots, mini cameras, and knives and boots like Jethro Bodine from... had when he was a double knot spy.
All right.
A lot of this information is out there, right? I mean, so how long has some of this early Cold War stuff been declassified and out in the public?
That's what happens over time. Information that was once very secret at the time of the particular technology, for example, the sub-miniature cameras that we used, which were small for... They're film cameras, smaller than the end of the pinky finger. Those sub-miniature cameras developed in 1970 at the time were just beyond state of the art. Well, of course, by year 2000, you have digital photography worldwide, and so the film-based cameras, you see, essentially become technologically obsolete. So it depends on what the device is and what the technology involved is, how long something remains sensitive.
I would imagine that these days that the spy out in the field could pretty much just log on to eBay or Amazon.com and get himself pretty well equipped.
Well, you know, that it's a really an important point you're making there, because 30 years ago, there were only a handful of national intelligence services that had the capability to produce the type of equipment that was necessary for espionage operation. Today, with the iPhone, with the BlackBerry, with the internet, spy gear that we could have only dreamt about in 1975 is literally in the hands of every man. And this means all of our adversaries, as well as people who just want to play around with it. Think about the Mumbai attack in India last November, and that entire operation was really planned, coordinated, and directed as the terrorist assault was going on by the use of the internet, GPS, that type of gear, the kind of gear that you can buy on the street.
So yeah, a lot of the technology is pretty readily available to everyone.
Well, I'm sure you had to...
Yeah, the technology is available for everyone. Now, I also want to make the point that these people in the CIA continue to adapt the technology to the specialized requirements of espionage. So there are two levels that one really needs to talk about.
Well, so you had to get, I'm assuming, all the things that you talk about in here, you had to get passed by the CIA and get sort of, you know, their approval on some of it, right? Or
yes, I skipped over that earlier question. I didn't mean to apologize for doing that. The since this hadn't been written about in the context that we were writing, and as a career CIA officer, I signed an agreement when I joined the agency that I would not publish information that was operationally sensitive or was classified, and so this our manuscript was subject to the Publications Review Board. Now, the original submission that we provided didn't go so well. We sent them 774 pages, and I got a letter back a few months after I'd sent it in that said, 740 pages are unacceptable.
Wow. Well, so
that would have been a pretty thin book, you know. even Jake could have read that one.
I would have finished that in the time that I had allotted.
Well, so clearly you got to some negotiation. What was the oddest one that they originally didn't want you to talk about that then you got to go ahead?
Well, it, that was the real issue. It wasn't that the agency focused on anything specific. They just said the whole topic of discussing the spycraft gadgets was off limits. Well, we put together a very compelling case about how much was really out there in the open world, how much had already been written about. College. I'm coming right out of the agency, so I have a pretty good sense of what is sensitive and what isn't. And you know, over about 18 months, we got that decision reversed.
It wouldn't occur to me that the CIA would be troubled by any bureaucratic mumbo jumbo. Barrett, you had a question?
No, Peter kind of covered it, but I was kind of curious. Like, how far ahead are we? As far as the tech goes, like, is there any consumer homebrew tech that's getting close to eclipsing, you know, the things that your group worked on to the point you just said, forget it, let's just get it off the internet, or even forget it, let's just use the internet?
Well, really, since the earliest days, the combination of available technology, available capability, has always been integrated with the special needs of the espionage. In fact, it's the model of the United States. It's almost unique in the world because during the Second World War, we didn't have time to develop our own laboratories, our own secret research facilities for this.
I think the CIA might be jamming your call. Are you on a cordless phone?
I am on a cordless phone. That's
I would ask
correct.
That you maybe move closer to the base station. It was fading out a little bit, and it was getting a little worse, so I just wanted to rein that in, see if we could get it a little clearer, but continue.
Okay, I apologize for that.
No worries.
Is this any better?
It sounds better already.
Okay. And it was a unique American style, a unique American model that said we are going to use the technology of the commercial sector and really bring the private sector directly into the development of spy gear contrasted to the way the British did it, for example. And that pattern has continued to today. So there's a very strong relationship between the intelligence community, development people, and the private sector.
So being familiar with all of this stuff, did it end up where, like, something new and cool that all the rest of us were out raving about that you're looking at and going, yeah, been there, done that, seen that?
Well, I would say that the digital cameras, when they came out, that was kind of my reaction.
Right. 3 megapixels? That's nothing.
So let me ask you this. Does the CIA hold any patents on anything that we buy commercially?
No, the CIA doesn't hold any patents on it, but several technologies that we write about in spycraft have transferred to the private sector. Perhaps most significantly, the early batteries for the pacemaker came out of work that was being done at the agency. The microphones, the early high-impact microphones used in hearing aids came out of some agency work for the hot air balloon industry.
Yeah.
Really grew out of experiments and work done by the technical people in the early 1950s when they were trying to figure out ways to infiltrate agents across the Iron Curtain, and hot air balloons was one of the devices that they tried very hard to develop that capability with.
What was one of the most interesting technologies that you saw from the other side during the Cold War? Some from the Russians, from the Koreans. Something
that
made you go,
wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, the first one that was just remarkable was actually in the early 1950s. In 1952, we discovered in a carved wooden replica of the Great Seal of the United States that hung behind our ambassador's desk in Moscow, a seal that was given to us, the carving that was given to us by Russian schoolchildren in 1946 because thanking us for our assistance during the Second World War. We discovered it had a passive resonator, listening device buried inside that, and we'd never seen anything like it because it didn't have any power. It was completely passive, and it was operated by a flooding technique from electronic flooding technique from across the street. That particular device, which we didn't understand for several years after we actually got a hold of it, was developed by a Russian optic acoustic genius by the name of Lev Theremin. Lev Theremin.
You're familiar with that.
And, you know, his technology was the basic technology for the Moog synthesizer. Well, it was a remarkable espionage.
How did you find it? In fact, Theremin
received the Stalin Prize for that particular device.
So did you discover it by going close to it, and it went, woo?
really by accident. We knew that we were having a leakage of some of our sensitive conversations. We couldn't figure out where it was coming from, and finally they just isolated enough the pieces, or eliminated enough pieces in the ambassador's office, that they said, boy, we better take a look at that great seal.
They just turned around and saw the giant microphone in the shape of an American eagle.
Why haven't you guys ever been able to get the cone of silence actually working the correct way?
We did it. The cone of silence about 10 years after you first saw it on Get Smart was developed. I call it the cube of silence, and it is a secure shielded enclosure. It eliminates any electronic signals from either entering or exiting. It's a room within a room, and it's been installed in hundreds of American sensitive locations around the world.
Was it actually inspired by the Get Smart? Because I know that some technology, and particularly the design of it, has been inspired by science fiction or by fiction. Is there anything that you saw in spy movies or James Bond where you guys said, oh, we have to make that?
Well, there is very true that particularly after the Mission Impossible episodes, the office would always get called saying, we just saw this on Mission Impossible. Can you do that?
in a
more contemporary way, one of my officers said to me one day, you know, every time one of these liberal arts case officers, guys like myself, get on an airplane and read the Sky Mall, you know, they say, oh, you know, we saw this really cool electronic device. Don't you have a spy equivalent of that? Well, you know, not really. The point, though, you know, something like the, remember the pen communicator? That was Man from U.N.C.L.E., right?
The pen
communicator. Well, a small audio device like that was exactly the kind of equipment that we worked on all the time.
So I was reading, you know, in the part of the book that I did get through in the first couple of chapters, they talked about some of the more low-tech things that the OSS had come up with, and one of them was about the incendiary bats.
Oh, yeah, did you like that one?
I thought that was...
What a concept, huh?
And apparently in the testing, they actually burned down a building, but it wasn't the one that they intended to do.
Well, you know, you have to test this stuff before you actually deploy it, or sometimes you test it. It's usually a good idea, shall we say, to test it before you deploy it. And this is it. We attach these little incendiary devices, or OSS engineers, to bats. And the idea was to drop the bats over Tokyo or some target in Japan where they have a lot of paper houses. So the bats would then fly under the roofs of the houses and the rafters of the houses, and then the incinerator devices would go off and the house would burn down and you'd create a fire throughout the city. Right? Good idea. So, yeah, we did test it. at an air base out in southwestern United States, and we successfully burned down an Air Force hangar.
and while we're on the subject of low-tech, inhumane spy gadgets,
were volunteer bats.
What about the cat, the swimming cat, the guided bombs that you use, the cat bombs?
Yeah, you know, the cat bombs, I don't know. I guess that's true, but, you know, the idea was that you could, again, strap explosives to cats and drop them and,
They would drop them in the water and they would guide, and the idea was, that, according to the book that you wrote, cat would swim towards whatever wasn't water, presumably a boat. and that the cat would then detonate and then blow up the boat. But they were, as we all know about cats, you can't strap anything to a cat. And expect the cat to do anything.
Did you get to Acoustic Kitty?
No, I did not get to Acoustic Kitty. Tell me about that.
We didn't strap anything to the cat, but actually we put a listening device, an audio device, in a cat. with a little battery. Now you guys laugh because that's you're not old folks like I am. You know this was
pretty high tech.
Well, it was high tech at the time because we didn't do artificial knees.
So then what would you give the cat as a gift to?
The operational need was there was a prime minister target in the Far East who let cats roam his office and his main conference room.
So it was no big deal to introduce a cat.
So the idea was to introduce a cat in there, and then the cat would wander around. Well, of course, the problem is you can't control where a cat's going to wander.
So it was just fading in and out.
Yeah, so we...
Was there ever technology where you faked that you had a more advanced technology than you really did to the other side?
Did you lead the enemy to believe that we had certain capabilities that maybe we didn't?
Like we've got buttered toast and cat technology? You guys don't?
Answer to that that's an interesting question. In all these dozens and dozens of interviews that I've done, I don't believe I've had that question asked to me before.
And if you can't,
there was substantial deception operations during the Second World War, of course, and deception operations continue to today, using the kinds of devices that we talk about are really intended to help a spy collect information and then communicate that information, though more than doing deception kinds of work.
Okay, fair enough. Do you have any gadgets from those days that you own personally? Did you just say, well, this is going to be my memento, my keepsake from my days? Do you have a microdot?
The answer is yes, I have a microdot. Now, most of the stuff that I have liberated from Keith Melton's collection.
Ah. Does he know?
Technology.
So technically, the ownership might be in dispute. No, Keith has been very, very generous with, we have the sub-miniature cameras, we have microdots, we have audio devices, listening devices, and most famously we have Randy, the 35-year-old freeze-dried rat.
Randy, the 35-year-old freeze-dried rat, and how does he constitute being a spy tech device?
Well,
a spy craft
one of
device.
One of the things that you have to do is covertly deliver gadgets or information or instructions to your agent. And one of the ways we found that was effective to do that was to eviscerate a rat and use a freeze-dried technique. And you have a cavity. Think about a rat. You have a body cavity of about 3 inches long and with a cylinder then inside of about an inch in diameter. So you can put cameras, you can put code books, you can put currency, you can put all kinds of things inside a rat. And you leave it at a particular dead drop site, it's unlikely that any passerby is going to pick up that rat
and check to see if it's
really
there.
I'm sorry.
they're not going to look inside it if they bother to pick it up.
Well, so, if they pick it up, we're in trouble because that means the agent didn't get our stuff.
That's true.
We sure hope.
If you have a tracking device in it, the cat might have gotten away.
Well, so
when that was developed, the tracking devices weren't at the technical level that they are today. But yes, certainly today, you wouldn't even have to tell your agent where it was until you put it down, because you could put a tracking device in it, and the agent could have a system that could lead him to the ramp.
Right, on his iPhone.
Well, so how did Mr. Melton end up with such an extensive collection? It's not like there's a yard sale at the CIA and you can go pick up the old, mini cameras or microdots or those kinds of things. How did he come about acquiring some of this technology?
He really has been interested in this throughout his his lifetime. He's a graduate, a 1966 graduate of the Naval Academy, and you know, he spent a lifetime as both as a businessman and as an amateur intelligence historian collecting this gear. He acquired a large percentage of it 1990, 1991, 1992, when the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe broke up and communism was kicked out. A lot of the spy gear that they had captured or that they had was now available.
And so when the Stasi...
Very aggressive and successful in getting it.
So when the Stasi and the KGB had garage sales, you went and got the equipment.
Well, I would imagine so.
I never have heard it expressed that way, but yeah, you got it. I'll use that in the future, if I may.
There's the freeze-dried rat. I just found the picture of him in the book. Okay, now, one thing you mentioned in the book, too, are the disguises. You have a picture of Keith Melton as an aging Russian alcoholic.
Sure.
And so that whole Mission Impossible thing where they would rip the mask off and it would be, you know, just a remarkable transformation. Were the levels of how would they use a disguise like that? Would they actually interact with people, or would that just be for like passive surveillance?
Yeah, the early disguises was very, very hard if you have close up encounters in a disguise. But over time, again, here's where materials technology became very significant, and with silicone especially, you're able to do remarkable things in terms of matching skin texture and skin movement or muscle movement, and so yeah, disguises really beginning with work we did with John Chambers, who won the Academy Award for the articulated masks in Planet of the Apes.
Oh yeah,
coming off of a lot of that Hollywood experimentation and work, we were able to construct disguises by the 1980s that were remarkably lifelike and could actually be used in close-up conversations or encounters.
Wow. All right. So, well, the book it looks fascinating, and it has, you know, it's pretty thick, and it's got good pictures in it and stuff. So I've started reading. It's quite enjoyable, and it sounds like you really, you really put a lot out there in terms of what the agency was up to and what they were doing. It seems almost like you shouldn't be reading the book.
Is there a Kindle version of it?
Yes, there is.
Uh-huh. Actually, and you knew the answer too.
Right.
I think $9.99 or something like that.
I'm getting it right now. I got a Kindle DX here, and I am getting it.
Do you like that? What do you think of that Kindle?
Well, this is a review unit. I just got it. When you first hold it, it just feels like, oh, this is too big. But as you sit down in like an easy chair and kind of read it like you would a book, the size feels like a hardback book, and the weight is a little bit like a small hardback.
Okay.
So it's actually more comfortable. Reading it in bed, though, is not comfortable. You need the little one to read in bed. But for easy chair reading, it's quite comfortable.
All right. Now, Mr. Wallace, we did have from our listenership, we had a couple of questions. One in particular was a question about if there was a particular type of foil that someone might use to block their brain waves from being read by CIA, technology.
I cannot name the manufacturer, but if you put tin, well, it works.
Is it shiny side in or out? I think was one of the
questions.
That
was the other part of the question. Shiny side in or out, or does it make a difference?
Do you want to deflect or receive?
You're probably not going to tell us which one's which, are you?
That's a great answer. All right. Well, we really appreciate your time. We're not going to take up any more of it, but we really appreciate you calling in and talking with us tonight. It was quite fascinating, and I understand you have family here in Houston, so if you find your way back down to visit again, you know, drop me a line and maybe we'll have another conversation.
Look, I would really enjoy doing it. I'd like to mention my website if I could do that.
Absolutely.
It's www.ciaspycraft.com. That's CIASPYCRAFT.
And the name of the book, CIASPYCRAFT.com, and the name of the book is simply Spycraft, The Secret History of the CIA Spy Techs from Communism to Al-Qaeda, and again, I'm just getting started with it, but it's a great read, and I encourage you to check it out if you're interested in spies and technology. And Mr. Wallace, thank you so much for your time this evening.
It's been fun talking to you guys. All the best.
All right, same to you.